I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. It is both painful and deeply moving to read Carmen Maria Machado's new memoir, In the Dream House. It's about how an obsessive relationship she had with another woman while in graduate school turned abusive, how attention and desire became control and jealousy and rage. Machado writes in the second person, you, which has a way of drawing the reader in, making a personal connection with the author. Each chapter refers to a different genre. Dream House as fantasy, Dream House as spy thriller, Dream House as American Gothic. She also captures how trauma can fragment memory and how psychological violence can tear a person apart. A reviewer for NPR wrote, Dream House is the kind of book that burrows under the reader's skin while simultaneously forcing her to inhabit the body of the writer. I agree. Carmen Maria Machado's previous collection of short stories, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award. She's writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Carmen Maria Machado, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and thank you for writing this book.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, we sort of started the interview a couple minutes before we went on the air here, and I did say it was painful to read this book. It was many other things as well, but it had to have been painful to write.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely not a pleasant experience that I would repeat if I had my way.
And yet you wrote it.
I did.
To the very end. And it's published.
Yes.
And what do you think? I mean, now that strangers are reading your memoir, What do you think?
I mean, it's very scary. I mean, it's an experience of being very, you know, it's very raw. It's very strange to have your life sort of on display for strangers. I mean, with fiction, you know, I write a lot of autobiographical material in my fiction, but with fiction, you can still say like, oh, I made it up. Like, you know, and then that's sort of the end of that conversation. But, you know, having sort of all these, like the worst thing that ever happened to me sort of, you know, out in the world for people to read it's very strange. It's an experience that, I mean, I sort of, I guess, intellectually understood it, you know, how it was going to happen. But I think having it sort of happen in real life is just very, very strange.
It's interesting to write about the worst thing that ever happened to you. But as a writer, there has to have been something for you, something
sure.
for yourself to be able
sure.
to write about this chapter in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I needed. I've been saying I feel like it's like a kidney stone I had to pass. Like I had to sort of, you know, I love writing fiction, and I really wanted to get back to fiction, but it was something I had to kind of get out of my system. And so, I mean, I'm glad for that reason that it was something that I managed to, like, you know, to pass it, as it were.
Pass that kidney
yeah,
stone.
Yeah, exactly. To like get it out of my body, so I could do some other stuff.
You have several quotes before you even begin the book. One from Zora Neale Hurston, who wrote, "If you were silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it." You also told Vulture that writing the book kind of killed a little part of me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was working on it, and I like to go to residencies when I write. I like to go away from home just because I find it sort of more easy to write when I'm just sort of in nature, and I'm just sort of, you know, I don't have any sort of day-to-day responsibilities. I'm just sort of there working, and that's been very helpful for my fiction. But I did this while I was writing the memoir, and it actually ended up being kind of a mistake because I was sort of isolated and far away from my spouse and away from my friends, and you know, I just... And I just sort of sat in this house and wrote and, you know, would just sort of write. And then I'd get up at some point and walk around, and then I would eat a little, and then I would go back to writing. And there was sort of no break and no pause. And I think by the end, I really felt as if, yeah, like I had been sort of altered in a fundamental way.
Right.
But having returning to this material so in such a concentrated way really, like, changed me.
In a good way? I mean, do you feel better for it?
Not I want to say soon. Yes. I mean, I wish I could say, oh, I'm better for having written it. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I'm better. I think I'm different. Maybe the jury is out on whether or not I'm like what the sort of long-term effects of having to return to this material, like what the sort of long-term effects are. But definitely it was not, I don't feel better. I don't, unfortunately.
Well, you use you, the second person, you. As I mentioned in my introduction, of course, it does several things. One is to speak to me directly as the reader. So I'm saying you when it's you. I mean, it's an interesting kind of messing with our heads there. But it also, I think, speaks to the fact that we are we human beings are several selves.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I really love the second person, and I think it's actually really, it's really versatile. I think it gets a bad reputation for reasons I don't fully understand, but I really love it. And I think, yeah, the ability to speak to a reader directly, but also, yeah, to a past self. And so for me, it became about, I actually wrote the first draft unintentionally in second person. Uh-huh. Like, it was just sort of how it came out of me. And my editor, my bless him, was like, you know, we should talk about the fact that you wrote this in second person. And I was like, oh, yeah, I have to get that sort of figured out. But ultimately, it actually ended up being, I think, because I'm having a conversation with, like, this young version of myself who's, you know, in her early 20s and is on this eternal hamster wheel of pain and is just sort of running through it. And I'm not speaking to her because she can't hear me. Right. You know, I mean, in the book, I talk about time travel and about the Nabokov self-consistency principle, this idea that if time travel were possible, that you wouldn't be able to alter the past because the past, by definition, has already happened. And so I feel like writing this book was a lot like that, where I was like coming up against the glass to this like young version of myself. And I have all this context and experience and thoughts about what happened to her, but she can't access any of that, you know? And so in many ways, I was writing the book like toward her or at her.
Mm-hmm. But she didn't hear it.
She didn't hear it. And I mean, I think it was important to me because I do think that we are so much easier on other people than we are on ourselves. And it was easy for me to sort of feel more tender toward her, thinking about her as almost this other person or this other self as opposed to me.
Well, it is about falling in love with a woman who is obsessed, becomes obsessed with you, and that feeling of being desired, of being wanted, of being needed, and how sexy that is, but how exciting and how life-affirming it is. I wonder if you could read a section from your book, Dream House as Inciting Incident, page 15, just the last paragraph there.
Yeah. Dream House as Inciting Incident. Every time she speaks, you feel something inside you drop. You will remember so little about the dinner, except that, at the end of it, you want to prolong the evening, and so you order tea, of all things. You drink it, a mouthful of heat and herb, scorching the roof of your mouth, while trying not to stare at her, trying to be charming and nonchalant while desire gathers in your limbs. Your female crushes were always floating past you, out of reach, but she touches your arm and looks directly at you, and you feel like a child buying something with her own money for the first time.
Oh, I mean, there's so many passages in your book that are like that, with just the richest, most descriptive kind of language. But this idea of, and I really appreciate how you write about female desire, female, you know, these sexual impulses and feelings that women have, but I don't think it's talked about or written about very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that was so interesting about writing this book was realizing that so much of sort of what drew me to this person was desire, this sort of untapped desire, and the fact that, I mean, I am, you know, a fat woman. I sort of was a late bloomer in terms of my relationships. And I think, you know, realizing, I had sort of internalized, I think, for a long time that, you know, to be loved would be a gift because I didn't deserve it, you know? And so when suddenly someone who I thought was really attractive and wonderful and amazing was like, I want you, I need you, it was the most intoxicating thing in the entire world. And I think to say, I mean, so when people are like, well, why did you stay? Like, why, what drew you to this person? I mean, the honest answer is a lot of it was desire and want, and this thing that was tapped in, that was being tapped into, that I simply hadn't had tapped into before.
In fact, you write about an obsessive love in college where you, and I'm almost quoting you here, drove across four states to sleep with a man. You say the sex was bad, but you wanted that desire.
Yeah.
The desire that took you across four states.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted it. I mean, I feel like it's so weird to say that. And I think, yeah, it's unusual, especially for women, to sort of articulate that want. But like to say, like, yes, I was, you know, I wanted something that badly.
You write also, you would let her swallow you whole if she could. I mean, this is, of course, the beginning where you just feel on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't name her. I don't know how much of what you actually write in here is truth to her. But as I was reading, I was wondering, does she know who she... We don't know who she is, but does she know who she is in this book?
I don't know. I can't say. I mean, the book exists, so...
Does that worry you, concern you?
No.
just, it speaks for itself.
Yeah.
And this is your truth.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to, and I don't think this is giving too much away to say that this desire and this obsession, we see it become control, and then we see it become jealousy, and then rage, and even, dare I say, hatred.
Yeah.
That's all sort of part of this obsessive love.
Yeah.
Do you think that's what obsessive love is about, or was this her version of it?
You know, I think we, unfortunately, sort of, culturally, for reasons I don't fully understand, really fetishize jealousy. I mean, fetishize, you know, we say, oh, it's romantic for somebody to be obsessed with you. It's romantic for somebody to, you know, if you look at a person of the gender that you're attracted to, you know, that's like unacceptable, or you can't have friends that belong to the gender that you're attracted to, except for your partner or your boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or whoever. And I don't know why. And it really bothers me. And it bothers me how easily we normalize it. And I think that there's a lot of things going on, or there were a lot of things going on in this relationship. Mm-hmm. But I think one of them is that, yeah, for some people, that kind of obsessive jealousy just is, it's supposed to be, it's sort of normalized and treated as a thing that's very romantic, when in fact it's incredibly damaging and very alarming. And it's like a million red flags, you know. And in retrospect, that seems obvious to me.
Sure.
But at the time, I don't think I fully understood.
Well, there are numerous frightening moments in this where, on the one hand, she would be screaming at you about you, essentially. And then 5 minutes later, you know, wanting to be intimate with you. Or asking you, well, why are you crying?
Yeah. I mean, then that sort of cyclical, you know, I mean, there's a part in the book where I talk about, you know, running from her and having to lock myself in the bathroom. And I remember after a series of these incidents, you know, she would cry and I would have to comfort her. So, like, I would have been sort of terrorized within an inch of my sanity. And then, you know, she would feel bad about what had happened, or she would feel distressed about the situation. And then I would have to comfort her. And it always sort of turned back on itself. And, you know, by the time I would sort of leave her home, or I would go back to my sort of regular life, like, suddenly I would have made an excuse for it, or I'd be like, oh, it wasn't that bad, or like, it ended well, you know, which again is like actually quite classically, I mean, is the cycle of domestic violence. I mean, it's that, or domestic abuse. I mean, that is the cycle. But of course, again, at the time, like, I didn't really have that context.
Yeah. And we're almost up on a break here, but you didn't have that context. I mean, it's psychological abuse among partners is out there, maybe more straight partners than partners of same sex. Is that why?
Well, it isn't about the numbers about how it actually happens, but rather the sort of the narratives that we had to talk about it. So, like, in the book, I talk about how, you know, as a young person, I was really attracted to a female friend of mine in high school, but I just didn't have any like sort of contextual narrative for queer desire. And so I didn't understand that meant that I was queer. And in the same way, like, I think because of the narratives that we have about domestic abuse or intimate partner violence are often always sort of heterosexual, they're white. I mean, there's a lot of sort of ways in which they're shaped by these narratives. And so there just isn't context for that for same-sex couples.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Carmen Maria Machado is our guest. She's got a new book. It's a memoir called In the Dream House. You can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Carmen Maria Machado. She's got a new memoir called In the Dream House. Her short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her essays, fiction, and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Granta, Harper's Bazaar, Tin House, and elsewhere. She's also writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. There are three sections I'd like to have you read, and I think sort of speaks to what we were talking about right before the break.
Yeah. Dream house as deja vu. She loves you. She sees your subtle, ineffable qualities. You are the only one for her in all the world. She trusts you. She wants to keep you safe. She wants to grow old with you. She thinks you're beautiful. She thinks you're sexy. Sometimes when you look at your phone, she has sent you something stunningly filthy, and there is a kick of want between your legs. Sometimes when you catch her looking at you, you feel like the luckiest person in the whole world. Dreamhouse as deja vu. She says she loves you. She says she sees your subtle, ineffable qualities. She says you are the only one for her in all the world. She says she trusts you. She says she wants to keep you safe. She says she wants to grow old with you. She says she thinks you're beautiful. She says she thinks you're sexy. Sometimes when you look at your phone, she has sent you something weirdly ambiguous, and there is a kick of anxiety between your lungs. Sometimes when you catch her looking at you, you feel like the most scrutinized person in the world. Dreamhouse as deja vu. She says she loves you sometimes. She sees your qualities and you should be ashamed of them. If only you were the one for her. She'd keep you safe. She'd grow old with you if she could trust you. You're not sexy, but she will have sex with you. Sometimes when you look at your phone, she has sent you something stunningly cruel, and there is a kick of fear between your shoulder blades. Sometimes when you catch her looking at you, you feel like she's determining the best way to take you apart. Mm.
Devastating, I have to say. I mean, even to read that for the second or third, or to hear that read is just to, in a sense, I feel kind of torn apart myself.
Yeah, it's weird. It's so weird reading it out loud because some parts of it, I feel like I've read them over and over again. So I almost feel like there's like a sheath of sort of ritual around them. But those sections I haven't read out loud. So it's actually really interesting reading them even now. I'm like, ooh.
Well, to go from feeling like the luckiest person in the whole world to feel like she's determining the best way to take you apart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean that. And I feel like that sort of, you know, using the deja vu sort of details. Something I came up with really early on where I was thinking about what is a way that a thing can repeat itself while also sort of devolving on the page. And, you know, the way that she spoke about me and the way that sort of changed, you know, over the course of time and then also sort of circled back on itself. And, I don't know, just felt like really real and important.
I know fairy tales are something that really interests you. And in certain ways, reading this, and fairy tales are, I remember when my son was little, I would read him fairy tales, and I was 4 years old, and I'm telling him about the most scary things in the entire world.
Yeah.
But there is a sort of fairy tale quality in here about, you know, evil people, scary people, dangerous people.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because fairy tales, you know, I feel like there's sort of an understanding of them as being these very sort of sanitized things, but the originals obviously are horrifying. I mean, you know, I talk about like the original Little Mermaid in here and how like, you know, in that version, like her tongue gets cut out. I mean, it's very, very dark. And actually I ended up writing like a whole section about, you know, narratives of fairy tales in which speech is sort of removed, or identity is removed. But they're useful in this interesting way because, you know, fairy tales tell us about what we're afraid of, you know, and what we've been afraid of and how we sort of conceptualize and put narrative around our experiences. And so, they ended up being a very useful model, I think, for this book.
And was it helpful to you? I mean, to think of it in a way as a fairy tale, as you say, it's there's some distance on it because it's you, but whether to sort of see it in using those fairy tale tropes.
Yeah. And I think also because, you know, that's sort of one of the hardest things about writing about intimate partner violence or domestic abuse is that when you strip away all the details, you know, those stories actually repeat themselves. I mean, if you asked 10 random sort of survivors of domestic abuse to tell their story, like if you stripped away all the details, ultimately their stories would be very similar. And that's sort of hard because then you're like, how do I write a beautiful and interesting book about a thing that actually repeats itself so sort of aggressively? But I was thinking a lot about fairy tales and about the way that those are stories that also have repeated themselves but still have offered us a kind of language for talking about our experiences and our fears and our anxieties and our joys while also sort of repeating themselves and evolving across time and location. So yeah, they just ended up being a really helpful way of sort of, I don't know, giving me space to tell my story in a way that felt new even when it wasn't new.
You mentioned this earlier in the interview that if we think about domestic violence, we tend to think of it in terms of a heterosexual relationship.
Yeah.
Does that mean, I mean, obviously it happens in all combinations of relationships that should be a given. But on the other hand, did you feel as if you were sort of opening a door on something that had been either kept quiet, kept silent. People didn't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real, certainly it had been written about on some level, but there just wasn't the kind of discourse around it that I expected when I sort of went looking for narratives that would sort of just, you know, speak to my experience. And I think a lot of what it is that, you know, like other minority groups, queer people, you know, I mean, we're obviously we have, you know, marriage equality has happened in the United States, which is really wonderful, but we're still, you know, we can be fired in a lot of states.
Including
this one for our, you know, for being gay. And you know, there's all kinds of ways in which queer people are sort of in danger or sort of at risk. And there's this desire, I think, to perform goodness and morality and to say, like, we're not just human beings, we're better and we're best and we're perfect. And I think that anxiety has driven a lot of people to, like, sort of sublimate or not discuss, you know, problems within the community. And I think this happens in all kinds of sort of oppressed groups where, you know, instead of just saying, like, we're human beings and deserve human rights because we're human, we're, like, trying to prove something about ourselves that isn't necessarily true. And then a lot of people's stories sort of fall through the cracks.
But do you also, I want to pick up on that, but do you also, when the so-called mainstream that looks at people on the fringes and they see domestic violence or they see, you know, other problems, that then the whole group gets painted with that brush?
Yeah, and I think it's so funny because it's so nonsensical. When you push on that for a little bit, you're like, you know, yeah, like, obviously that doesn't, saying like, oh, this thing happens in this community doesn't mean that community doesn't deserve human rights. But unfortunately, I think when people aren't used to thinking in those terms, that it becomes, yeah, that's like a sort of an automatic kind of assumption and it actually, I think, and it's very damaging. It's really harmful.
Which gets me to something that you wrote. Fantasy is, I think, the defining cliche of female queerness. And I think I'm beginning to understand what you mean by that. But expand on that for us.
Well, the way I've been sort of describing it is, you know, I dated men in the past. And I think, you know, even when you're dating, you know, a good guy, you know, having sort of male privilege in your house and having that dynamic in your house, it's sort of like having a low-level cold at all times. You know, there's just always this sort of element of you know, that there's that sort of that idea, that sort of masculine male privilege sort of exists in your space. And so when you're dating a woman and you're a woman yourself, that doesn't exist in the same way. And so that is a kind of, and I think I say in the book, you know, like, that is a real blessing, you know, and I think is sort of a kind of paradise. But also that doesn't mean that you can't have a bad relationship just because there isn't a man in it, you know. And unfortunately, and there's all these sort of cliches and stereotypes in the lesbian community, you know, the idea of, like, U-hauling, which is like,
yeah, you mentioned know, that U-hauling.
Yeah,
right?
This idea that, like, you know, like, it's sort of a cliche, a stereotype that, like, lesbians bring a U-haul to the second date, like, they just move in together immediately. And it's like, yeah, I feel like if you're a person who, maybe this is your first female relationship, where you're like, oh, wow, this is actually what I've been wanting this whole time, it can feel like this kind of paradise. But of course, and so, like, when I was doing all this research for this book, all the language around it would be like, you know, disrupting the sort of the lesbian utopia or the lesbian paradise. And I talk in the book about how even the rainbow, the symbol of the gay community, is actually like a symbol of a story in the Bible. You know, it's God promising not to be violent again, you know. And so I feel like there was just this very, like, sort of darkness around the fact that, yeah, we think about this paradise and we think about this utopia, but in fact, like, that's not a helpful way to think about these relationships. Like, they simply are and they're not necessarily going to be perfect in that way.
Well, here's a cliche, I don't even know if I believe it, but maybe when everything is boiled down, that we are people.
Yeah, you know, of course.
And we do things that people do.
Yeah.
I mean, some are straight couples, some are heterosexual couples, but there are some essential things that human beings do beyond the politics and the, you know,
totally.
All of that.
Well, and I think it's funny because I feel like it's actually, like, it seems so obvious to say it, right? Because it seems like, oh, of course, people are people. Some people want control. Some people, you know, are hurt in certain ways and will act that out on other people, you know. So, I mean, and that seems obvious to say, but for some reason it just gets complicated when you're talking about.
Even I said it, I felt like, that just sort of feels awkward.
And it's
weird.
Like, we don't have language for talking about, like, women who abuse or men who are abused, you know. We just don't have sort of narratives or language to talk about it, which is just, it's just not helpful to anybody.
I think you say, but maybe I read too much into it, that abuse among gay partners is a form of homophobia.
Yeah.
Did you say that?
That was an idea that I bring up in the book, and I sort of, like, kick it out there because it's, like, interesting to me, though I feel like I don't even resolve it in the text itself, because, well, I was thinking a lot about how, you know, in sort of heterosexual you know, when a man abuses a female partner, part of what's happening is sexism. It's understanding that you are not going to be taken seriously. You are at risk because you are a woman. And I feel like in the same way, like sort of one of the characteristics of abuse that happens in homosexual relationships or queer relationships is that there is a risk of being outed. There's a risk of not being believed, and that the abuse is partially possible because of the queer identity of the abused person. Mm. And that to me seems like homophobia, even if the person perpetrating that violence is themselves gay. So, it's sort of an idea that I kick out there. I'm like interested in it. I don't even know if I fully, like, I feel like there's like an entire book to be written about just that
I think there
exact
is.
Question, you know, but I was like, this is interesting. And I sort of was trying to resolve it for myself, and I don't know if I fully succeeded, but it was something that I was thinking about.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Carmen Maria Machado. We're talking about her memoir. It's called In the Dream House. She is writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. It's about a relationship she had while in graduate school with another woman, a relationship that began as a kind of obsessive love affair, turned controlling, turned psychologically violent, and happened a long time ago. I should say that she is married now, lives in in Philadelphia. So we are talking many ways about the past, but talking about such important and intimate and painful experiences, not alone. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You do describe going with this woman, who I should say is unnamed in this book, to visit her parents, her in Florida, I believe it is, and you see this moment of intimate violence there. I think it's in the kitchen, and the father is threatening. It sounds like threatening the mother. And this woman says to you, "I don't want to be like him."
Yeah,
and yet she is.
Yeah, I mean that was a moment. I mean, it's, you know, when I was writing the book, I mean, I feel like there was, I mean, one of the struggles of writing a book like this is, you know, thinking in a human way about this other person who's caused you great pain. And that, I mean, I don't promise to be perfect. And I think, you know, that was like a thing that was on my mind a lot while I was writing the book. But I remember in that moment and rewriting that moment and remembering that moment, thinking about how in that moment she recognized something that she was seeing in her own family and recognizing that she didn't want that for herself. And that creates, I mean, writing it was very hurt, you know, it hurt because I remember thinking like, yeah, like the sort of the sad thing about writing it is like, this is a person who has sort of internalized a certain dynamic. And recognizing that and sort of writing about that, I think was, I mean, yeah, it was a moment of vulnerability for her, you know, and I think, I mean, I say in the book, like, hurt people, and I think that there's something about seeing that and seeing how those dynamics reproduce themselves and play out that was really scary.
Well, it just shows you how powerful those early experiences are in sort of projecting us into our adulthood, what we see as children.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I can't. I mean, it's so strange because also it's like I'm not a doctor. Like, I'm not a, you know, I can only sort of look at it from like the one time I was there.
Yeah.
But it felt relevant. So I had to put it in the book.
She breaks up with you and get back together. I mean, this, you know, and again, this is a familiar pattern in a lot of ways. But as much as she was psychologically abusive and also, in a sense, you have a whole section about gaslighting, which seemed very apropos. Breaking up, even in an abusive relationship, is difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I want it to die. I mean,
Did you feel like your life depended on her?
Yeah, I felt like I couldn't imagine her not being there, even though she caused me such pain. And I remember, like, as the week sort of went on after it was finally over for good and feeling like I could breathe again and I could, you know, like, I talk in the book about how the joy of leaving my cell phone at home, because, like, she was so checked up on me so obsessively that to leave my phone alone even for a second was, like, unthinkable. And so I began to just leave my phone places. Like, I just wouldn't bring it with me. And the freedom of that moment was so important to me. And yet I still missed her. And that...
What did you miss?
I missed her voice. I missed her when she was... Like, the person she was when she was kind and funny. I missed having sex. I missed what it felt like to be good when things were good, you know, which felt amazing. And there was a sense of, a deep sense of loss, which is so strange to think about because it was so awful. And yet I remember thinking that I was mourning, and maybe I was mourning someone who never existed, but I was mourning a loss.
Were you mourning something about yourself too?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I kept imagining, like, no, I kept thinking no one will ever love me again. I kept thinking, like, that was it. I had it, and it was gone, and no one will ever. And I remember the first time I, like, hooked up with someone after after that experience was over and thinking, like, oh, maybe not, maybe. But, like, the fact that I was like, yeah, like, that was it. Like, I had the person who loved me, and then, and now she's gone, and I will simply never have that again. It was, like, a thought that occurred to me over and over again, and it was... Yeah, it was a lot.
But it sounded like you had friends. I mean, when the breakup was final, you had people that gathered around you that cared about you. And I probably were as concerned about this relationship as you are now.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, it was funny because, I mean, not funny, but it was interesting because when I, you know, when we were dating, like, she got very obsessed with sort of who knew what. And, you know, she would say, like, well, who knows about this fight we had, or who knows about... And, you know, if I would say to somebody, like my roommates or a friend, she would sort of just not even try to charm them anymore. She would sort of ignore them. But then she'd get mad when I was with them. You know, she'd be like, oh, you're with that person. Like, they don't like me. And so I pushed some people away and I sort of stopped talking to some people. And then, when it was all over, I suddenly had these, like, all these friends, like, gathering around me saying, like, we've missed you. We love you. Like, we care about you. We're so sorry. I was really lucky because I think some people, like, you know, that isolation is very classic in domestic violence. And I think some people, like, they lose relationships for good and they don't have that. And so I feel incredibly lucky that my friends were like, we were waiting for you to come back. You know?
And almost I'm going to break here. One, I think this man says, you're okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, And I think people would sort of recognize that, like, what I needed, but also that I was going to make it.
And you did.
Yeah.
We're going to take a very short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation. Carmen Maria Machado is our guest. In the Dream House is her new memoir. It's getting, rave reviews. And we're talking about a difficult relationship she had, what she essentially learned about it. It happened a long time ago when she was in graduate school. She's now writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a comic book that's coming out tomorrow, so we have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, writer Carmen Maria Machado is our guest. We're talking about her new memoir. It's called In the Dream House. It's about how an obsessive love affair in graduate school turned into a control and jealousy and rage filled relationship. Her memoir is winning wide praise for its honesty about trauma, also the innovative ways that she wrote about this experience and its many meanings. And again, her previous short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Let me just quote something before we have you do another reading. And this is a section of the book that's it's sort of hard to talk about on the radio, but it's, if there's anything sort of how-to-ish in this book, maybe about how to break up with someone. This is sort of it. But you write, the first time it happened, the first time she yelled at you so much, you were crying within 30 seconds from waking. A record, she said, quote, the first 10 minutes of the day, I am not responsible for anything I say. This struck you as poetic. You even wrote it down. Sure, you would find a place for it in a book. Maybe. And there is humor in here. I have to say, I don't want everyone to think it's painful and hard to read. I'm sure hard to write as well. But there are moments of levity and lightness.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's funny because I feel like that actually is a thing that I needed. I mean, I remember my editor saying exactly that. He said, he's like, you know, I think this is working because there is levity, because if it was just this sort of unrelenting slab of pain, it would be unreadable. Yeah, like the reader would not be able to bear it. But yeah, there are moments of like levity and humor and lightness, which is just how I write. I mean, I think that I think of darkness in context, in the context of light. I mean, I think that's always been, that's true of my fiction as well. Like even when I'm writing about very, very dark topics, my fiction, sexual violence and all kinds of things, like there is still a sort of levity and humor because you have to have that to survive and to be able to make it, you know? And so, yeah, so this book definitely has a lot of moments of sort of cheekiness and lightness.
I mean, that sounds like you. I mean, it's not just a writing technique, but that's...
That is me. You. That is also my personality.
I mean, we just met, but I can see that. Yeah. Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book.
Sure.
Near the end.
Dream House as Nightmare on Elm Street. 7 years on, and I still dream about it, even though I am 4 houses, 3 lovers, 2 states, 1 wife past the dream house, and the dreams aren't terribly unlike those I had when I was a kid, the ones in which I could hear the distant thumping of footsteps of some unseen monster. The footsteps never sped up or slowed down, but remained horribly, terribly even, and when I tried to hide, because hiding was all I could do, there never seemed to be the possibility of opening the door and going out into the world beyond the house. There'd be creatures in my way. A skeleton under the bed, a ventriloquist dummy behind the shower curtain, a zombie in the closet. And while they were terrible, I had the sense in the dream that they were sharing, that I could not share a hiding space with them. I also recognized that they were hiding because they were scared, smaller monsters terrified of that large, unseen thing. And as I ran from room to room, the steady footsteps of the oncoming thing never faltered. And so 7 years on, I am still terrified that if I force myself awake, as I learned to do as a child, she will step out of the dream and into the waking world where I am safe and so far away.
So many things there in that the monsters are also scared. I really like that. I mean, it does, in a sense, humanize them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that you're safe, but there's something out there.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think, you know, and I mean, in many ways, this is sort of me kind of trying to reconcile that past self and the present self, right? Where it's like the present self is, you know, like living her best life and is, you know, generally speaking, like very happy and content in my life. And I feel good about my choices and I'm safe and far away, you know, as I say. But there is this sort of this thing, this like tunnel that exists to this past place and trauma is like that, right? Where it can return you very suddenly to a place that is sort of really far that is distant from you. And it's like a wormhole or something. And you can just suddenly end up at the other side of it without even realizing it, even if you're feeling sort of very stable and safe and good on this side. And so, yeah, that moment of like trying to connect those things and thinking about, and sleep is a way that happens, right? I mean, and that idea of dreaming, which is what, you know, the book is called In the Dream House. This idea of dreaming is like your body is somewhere, but your mind is in this other place, right? And you're on a threshold. You're in a liminal space, like you exist in the middle somewhere. And you can sort of move between those things. And I mean, that is trauma. I mean, that is what trauma is like.
Sure. And what trauma does to memory. I mean, sort of how it fragments yourself and even the impulse to bury painful memories.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, who wants to relive them?
But
writing a book like this, you need them.
Yeah, you have to just excavate. I mean, it's so, and memory is so funny. I remember like at some point, my spouse read a version of this book and remembered something that had happened that I had not mentioned. And I remember, and she was like, oh, I noticed you didn't write about this thing. And I was like, oh my God. And I realized that my brain had jettisoned it. Like my brain had literally sent it away somewhere. And only by her remembering it did it suddenly come back to me. And then I wrote about it. But I was like, God, memory is so weird that way. And it wasn't even like a particularly bad thing. It was actually kind of a pleasant memory. But for some reason, like it was just like my brain had just decided that it wasn't going to hold on to that thing anymore. And yeah, memory is so strange that way. And trauma just operates in such a bizarre way. I mean, I did a lot of reading about trauma when I wrote this book and like The Body Keeps the Score and things like that. And it was very instructive.
What's interesting, too, is you're married to Val, who was in a relationship with this woman before you were.
Yes.
Just to further complicate our discussion. But there must have been so much history that you had to excavate or understand or share together.
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning,
we had this person in common.
Yeah. And I think in the beginning, I just saw this thing the other day that was really funny where someone was like, one should not behave so badly that people bond over the fact that they survived you, which I thought was like a pretty funny thing to say. And I feel like in many ways in the beginning, yeah, that was what we, you know, we became friends because we were trying to sort of figure out sort of what kind of language to put to what had happened and just sort of trying to make sense of what had happened and sort of share experiences. And it was quite helpful and useful. And then eventually that sort of blossomed into something more. And we've now been together for 7 years.
And you're married.
And we're married. Yeah. Yeah.
So like a fairy tale, a happy ending.
It's something. Yeah, it's like that. It's funny because it's in the middle of all this sadness. There's something really interesting about that having come out of it. And it's actually weird because I always think to myself, like, if I could go back, you know, would I do it again? If I knew what I knew now, would I just like not get together with this person? But the fact is that like this wonderful human being who I love more than life itself, like came out of, like our relationship came out of this place of great pain. And so I feel very lucky that even though, you know, everything that sort of preceded it was really difficult, that I got really lucky and I got to meet this person.
Have you always been a writer?
I have. I was one of those kids who, I mean, I read voraciously and was read to voraciously by my family, and wrote books. I'm putting quotation marks around that as early as I could. My father had this special stationery, and I would like steal packs of it and write little books and staple them together. And very dark, weird little books that I based on. Like I was reading a lot of Shel Silverstein and Roald Dahl, and I would sort of write my own like very weird dark stories, and then I would put them in these little books and distribute them to people. And as soon as I learned how to write letters, which a teacher taught me how to do when I was like maybe in third grade, I would write letters to publishers. What I would send my stories to them. I had special stationery that my godmother had given me for my birthday or Christmas or something one year. And I would just write letters to publishers saying like, here's a chapter of my book.
Did you ever get a letter back?
Never from a publisher, but I did. There's this really wonderful young adult writer named Olivia Bitten Jackson who'd written this book called I Have Lived 1,000 Years, which was about the Holocaust. And I had read it and was very disturbed by the fact that her family is taken away by the Nazis, it was nonfiction, that she had a book of poems that had been left behind. When the book concluded, she had never said if she had gotten her poems back. And I was very, as somebody who had read Little Women as a young woman and was very disturbed by stories of like manuscripts going missing or like, you know, your writing being taken away from you, I was very upset by this. And so I wrote her a letter, care of her publisher, saying, did you ever get your poems back? And about a month later, my mother came into the house and she said, there's a letter here for you from Israel. She was like, what?
And how old were you?
I was maybe like 9 or something.
Oh my gosh.
And she had written, she had said, my publisher, you know, forwarded me your wonderful letter. And I never got my poems back, but I obviously went on to write many books, and it was really lovely. Yeah. So yeah, it was this really magical moment of somebody reaching back. And, yeah, I don't know. I just really, yeah. So I've always been a writer. And even when I was in college and I studied photography, my own father, who's an engineer, so this was a big deal because he wanted me to like have a job with health insurance. Like he was very practical. But even he was like, I know you love photography, but you've always been a writer. You've been a writer since you were a little girl. You know, you have to remember that. And so, yeah, it's always been in my body somewhere. It's always been really important to me.
Do you still use a camera? Do you photograph?
I do. Well, I have. I have an earnest Instagram account. I don't know.
Oh, do you?
I do take photos sometimes. I mean, when I was in grad school, I had a little side business. I did some author photos for some friends. And then now I sort of do it just sort of idly. And I do love it. And I think actually my writing is very visual. I think like there is a sort of visual sensibility to it, which I think comes from having that training. And I do love photography, but no, it's not a thing that I really do very much of anymore.
A perfect segue to the fact that DC Comics is debuting your comic called The Low, Low Woods.
Yes.
How did this come about?
At this point, I guess it must have been like a year and a half ago, DC Comics reached out to me and said, we really loved your first book. We were wondering if you wanted to do a horror comic for us. And I actually had like an idea for this story that I had imagined was maybe going to be a YA novel, like sort of just tucked away in my notes somewhere. And so I was like, maybe this would be a good comic. And so I pitched it and they accepted it. Oh, wow. And so, yeah, now the first one is coming out tomorrow on the 18th on Wednesday. Wednesday. And yeah, it's about these, it's set in a fictional version of Centralia. I feel like now that I'm
That's on fire.
Yes, the city that's been on, the town that's been on fire for many decades now. It's funny, I've been doing a lot of interviews about it and never in Pennsylvania, no one ever knows what I'm talking about, but y'all would know, right? Yeah. So it's a fictional version of Centralia and it's set in the 90s and it's these two like queer teens trying to solve some mysteries about their town. And the town is on fire.
And the town is called Shudder to Think?
Shudder to Think, Pennsylvania, yes.
I read a quote, two teenage girls wake up in a movie theater with hours missing from their lives, and when they ask questions, they quickly learn that no one around them is entirely what they seem, except perhaps the skinless man in the deep woods and the deer woman who appears by midnight, by moonlight.
Yes, yes. Lots of monsters, lots of body horror. I mean, it's a really sort of, I mean, there's a really amazing illustrator, Danny, who's doing the art, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it's really gorgeous and very upsetting, and I love it so much.
How different was that from writing, let's say, fiction? I mean, just sort of fiction for like a short story that would be in a book somewhere.
It's really different. I mean, because it's script, basically.
And
which
it's
is
visual. I mean, it has to be.
Exactly. Like, I have to sort of describe what I want the art to look like, which is like, again, like, yeah, it has that visual piece of it. And I remember like them telling me early on, they were like, oh, you know, like when you have a surprise on the page, you want to make sure it's on the even page and not the odd page so that the reader turns the page and then sees the surprise or sort of so there's a lot of things that I sort of hadn't really considered or ever thought about. But it was really fun to write. I mean, writing a script was like very different. And writing these characters, I mean, it was stretching my comfort zone in a lot of ways, but I really, really loved it. And I had a great time doing it. And I'm very excited for it to be in the world.
Do you go to the movies? I mean, does that
I
help?
I do. I
to
love
help,
movies.
To yeah. help to sort of understand the visual world?
Yeah. And I think a lot about movies. I mean, I think a lot about them. I mean, I usually, my first book had a story called Inventory, which is about a woman's sort of sexual life as a pandemic is tearing across the United States and killing a lot of people. And I always talk about it in terms of this movie that I really love called Children of Men, which also is a movie that, you know, has like a foregrounded narrative and a very large backgrounded narrative that you can sort of track in different ways every time you see it. And I think thinking about that, so I feel like writing that story felt very visual in that way because I was thinking about these two sort of moving pieces. So yeah, it's just a very interesting, I find the visual stuff is actually very important to me, and I love movies and I love visual art, and I think a lot about it when I'm writing. So definitely it's a piece of my practice, even if it's not a thing that I do so much anymore.
Here's a bit of a weird segue. The Hallmark Channel reversed itself, saying there was a wrong decision when it yanked a commercial featuring two women kissing. They're getting married.
Yeah,
they're kissing, and a group protested. They didn't want to see that. They pulled it and then they put it back. Does that tell us anything about where we are today?
You know, it's so funny because I think a couple of years ago I wrote a piece for The New Yorker about sort of when the Boy Scouts, it was when the Boy Scouts were still, hadn't made their reversal, their decision about gay scouting or gay leaders rather, and sort of the way in which capitalism, it's weird. It's like, you know, money speaks. And so basically the way that, you know, nowadays it's like, you know, gay rights have come along far enough in the United States where it's actually like sort of in the best interest of corporations to not be homophobic. But that wasn't always the case. And the Hallmark Channel is interesting, I think, because probably their demographics are a little different than like a lot of other companies in terms of like their viewership or whatever. But, you know, the fact that it's like, what was the Million Moms group that like protested?
Yeah, but apparently they're only 25.
There's no million moms.
I know.
They're kind of the worst. They're really the worst people. That group is really terrible. But yeah, they like made a stink. The company made a choice and then obviously very quickly realized that it was not in their best interest sort of financially or sort of reputation wise to do so. So, you know, it's like not, I don't really feel like it's even about like morality per se. It's actually just about, it's money and how money speaks. And I think if people talk about it like it's very moral, and it actually is way more about
But does
money.
It say something? I mean, that
it says
at
that
least the capitalists are on your side.
Yeah, no,
maybe?
No, honestly, it says that money speaks. And I think that in that way, I mean, money speaks. And I guess in this case, gay folks are lucky that money was speaking for them. That's not always the case, but it is now.
Carmen Maria Machado, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And thank you for writing your book. It's really quite extraordinary.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is a memoir. It's called In the Dream House. And again, she's writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. And she's got a new comic book coming out, The Low, Low Woods. And her her short story collection, In Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist just a few years ago for a National Book Award. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.